This week, the yellow metal held firm, finishing near the break-even point on lowered expectations of rate hikes this summer. Well, welcome back. Chris Walczak with you this weekend for another big GoldSeek.com radio installment. Gold held its ground while most markets declined, holding on to over 20% annual gains, the best start in 10 years. Will the precious metals continue to sizzle or fizzle in 2016? Returning to the show with their market insights this week, Arch Crawford outlines his investing methods that he's honed over 40 years in the markets. He'd like to see the yellow metal hold above 1280, where he says buy with both hands. And U.S. equities could come under fire with the sell in May, walk away mantra, making the markets more attractive later this autumn. Then Louis Navalier of Navalier & Associates returns to the show, who prefers real money over flimsy paper currency, which carries a negative interest rate in many parts of the world. He likes precious metals as an essential core holding for every investment portfolio and recommends ratcheting up gold allocation. And he shares a couple of his favorite stock picks. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly sunny skies appeared over the precious metal sector this week. Gold finished at $1,294 an ounce, near the break-even point on Friday. Silver gave back only 36 cents, about 2%, after four explosive weeks, ending at $1,753 an ounce, while the XAU Shares Index shed merely 4 points, about 4.5%, after months of explosive rallies as well, ending near $88.50. Still higher by 100% for the year, and West Texas Intermediate crude dropped just $1.30 per barrel, about 3% at $44.66 a barrel, still one of the best positions in over 2 years. Crude bounced from the lows on news that oil sands disruptions in Canada and lower output in the U.S. was a big positive, lowering supply ahead of the typically strong summer vacation months. Meanwhile, gold reached the highest zenith in over a year this week on news from the U.S. Labor Department of the lowest employment reading in 7 months. Traders viewed the news as confirmation that Fed policymakers will hold rates steady at 0.5%. April payrolls indicated only 160,000 new jobs on Friday, about 50,000 fewer than most economists expected. U.S. GDP has declined for 3 consecutive quarters. In addition, private sector employment lost momentum, according to the Automatic Data Processing ADP on Wednesday. Employers added only 156,000 jobs in April, according to the report, the weakest since February 2014, over 2 years. Nonetheless, the national unemployment rate did hold steady at 5%, indicating some underlying strength. The current Fed funds futures indicate 87% odds of no rate hike at the upcoming Fed meeting, only a 13% chance of a hike to 75 basis points this summer. So that's more positive support for commodities, crude oil, and gold and silver. Precious metals bottom line. Well, the incredible precious metals rally paused this week, and that's viewed as a healthy sign. Silver must hold support and run to 1850 to stay in line with a potential assault on 20, while a close above 1300 would likely lead to a retest of 14 to 1500. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, amid one of the most volatile markets on record, the New York Stock Exchange continued its second week of profit-taking. The blue-chip Dow Jones shed about 33 points, finishing at 17,740, while the S&P 500 gave back about 8 points, less than 0.5%, finishing at 20,057, while the Nasdaq a little less than a percent, down to 47.36 for the week. The top story moving U.S. equities this week was clearly sluggish domestic economic numbers, including weaker than expected GDP recently, less than sanguine jobs numbers, as well as weaker earnings announcements. Investor confidence is stirred, maybe not fully shaken. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, market volatility as viewed by the CBOT VIX is innocuous here. However, the Fear and Greed Index continues to support lower prices in the coming weeks and months. I expect better valuations and buying opportunities later this year, perhaps after the typical sell in May and walk away period passes. And Arch Crawford, one of this week's guests, is also calling for buying opportunities as late as autumn. And we'd like for you to stop what you're doing for a moment, please, and imagine what it might be like to be hunted by an advanced alien force, similar to maybe Arnold's Predator. Our vegetarian brothers and sisters are under such an assault by sanguinary hunters who profit from selling their body parts Elephants are highly intelligent beings, like whales, who are known to pay respect to their loved ones and nurture infants who are struggling at birth. Please join me in a humble donation to halt the unnecessary and vicious ivory trade, EIA-global.org. That's EIA-global.org. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. My featured guest today, Arch Crawford, combines technical analysis with the planetary alignments in astronomy to find patterns in the markets. Arch has been at the helm of perspective.
It'll be 40 the 24th of May.
How about that? That's quite a tenure in the markets. Most people don't last more than a few years, but 40 years sounds to me like you might just be on to something. What do you attribute to your success?
Well, I was the first ever assistant to market technician Robert Farrell at Merrill Lynch, who was voted every year by institutional investor polls to be the best technician on Wall Street. I think he was every year but one during his entire reign at Merrill Lynch, and he's retired and still writes his own little thing for I don't know how many people, and I don't know what he charges for it, but he's I learned a lot while I was there at Merrill Lynch and studied a technical analysis before I went there, and I predicted the crash in 1962. I got there in like September of 1961 and predicted the crash of 62 after in I think November of 61, and it popped in December and crashed. It made a huge multiple head and shoulder top, and it broke the neckline the day John Kennedy made the steel companies roll back a price increase.
If you were forced to put a percentage on technical analysis versus fundamental analysis, would I be right in guessing about 90 to 10, about a 90% favoring of technical?
I would say yes, only the other composition that I use more heavily is the astronomic cycles work, and I do weigh those much heavier than fundamental and somewhat under technical. The thing is, I like it when the technical confirms the astronomic cycles. That's when I've had my best hits, and I've been number one in the country several times in the regular market and a couple of times in the bond market and once each in gold. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Since you've given me the perfect segue into the yellow metal, your thoughts about the recent improvement that we've seen in, obviously, in the activity for the precious metals. You know, we've seen a remarkable rally. Of course, now we'd also seen that over the last 5 years, and each time the rallies fizzled out later on in the year. This time around, it looks as though the precious metals stampede might have some momentum behind it. What are your thoughts, please?
Well, my thoughts are specifically that in the entire 5 years after the top, it never made an intermediate high above a previous intermediate high. Not once until this recent breakout.
And you know the irony there is? Gans Research, this unbelievable technician, didn't he accumulate something like $50 million, which back then would be multiples of billions of dollars today? 11 kids in his family, Texas, I think his father was a minister, a Baptist, and he just had this idea that he could apply mathematical, somewhat rigorous ideas to the markets, and it seemed to work for him.
And astrology. The early articles about him said the astrologer W.D. Gann, but he later than that, he silenced everybody who worked for him, had to sign a secrecy clause, and I actually met one of them once, and he said, yes, we did have to sign the secrecy thing, but we didn't know what he was doing anyway.
He didn't bother to tell anybody his inside info because he knew that eventually that would probably diminish the returns and his success. He kept his knowledge closely guarded. And, you know, I guess that's one of the reasons for these phone calls is we hope to garner our own W.D. Gann-like wisdom from Arch Crawford. Give us some of your inside tips.
In terms of the astrology, well, actually, basically, the cyclical things that are happening now are just regular mathematical cycles. We are getting into the time of year when they say sell in May and go away, because the market has a strong tendency to top in late April or May and bottom in October or November. We are at the point where that may kick in. Now, also, Joe Granville did a study on quarterly tops, talking about the relative to the earnings statements, so that your quarter starts off the first 5 or 6 days, nobody's reporting, and then they start usually the best ones earlier and the worst ones later. And that results in a high day. It doesn't have to be the high day of the quarter. It can be a high day for a few weeks and then a rally higher or not. But the high date that statistically comes out is the 18th or 19th calendar day of the month. Now, Joe Granville did that many years ago, and I caught it up in 1992, and it was still working. And I looked at it again like 4 or 5 years ago, and it's still working pretty well. As of April the 18th or 19th, that cycle kicks in. There's a cycle around the FOMC where the 2 days of the FOMC meetings tend to account for all of the major market gains of the last 2 or 3 years.
I have an article in this little humble dissertation I'm working on, peer-reviewed within the literature, within the field of finance and economics right now, and they claim that they've found that 90, 92, and 94% respectively of the Dow, S&P, and the NASDAQ, they attribute to news events, i.e. key announcements such as your FOMC announcement you just alluded to.
Yes. Well, somebody did this study, and they reported on it earlier this year, I think, about the FOMC gains. And that was, I had noticed that, but I hadn't done any statistics on it or that. So anyway, so the typical high of the month is option expirations date plus or minus 2 or 3 days very often. Now, this year, it's been less so, but the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a very high ranking. Mostly it's a high, and when it's not a high, sometimes it's a low or within a day or two of a low. So I would watch those dates, the option expiration dates, the FOMC dates. So when we have 2 or 3 things that indicate a topping, like the 18th or 19th of April is the 18th or 19th of the quarter, that indicates a high. Then we had option expiration, I think it was the earliest one this month was the 15th. And now we're getting into May, which is seasonal time of the year.
You know what that reminds me of? The market adage, the axiom. We've all heard the sell in May and walk away, but way back, buy when the sap is running up the trees.
Gee, I don't remember that one, but it is true that early spring is probably the best time of the year, generally, statistically. And in December, of course, we have the December is the strongest month, regularly the strongest month, and then April, I think, is second.
I have a library of outdated, out-of-print finance tomes from the 1800s. This is J.P. Morgan's time we're talking about here, so this is way back.
Well, I share a birth date with J.P. Morgan, who had a full-time astrologer on
yes.
staff.
Yes, you know, you've mentioned that.
See, before 300 or 400 years ago, everybody who knew anything had studied astrology first.
Oh, yeah, Newton was a well-known astrologer. Johannes Kepler. Well, he picked up the work of Brahe, who was also a fascinating character. You know, he had
I have a book on astrology from him, yes.
You know, he had a silver nose. Are you aware of that? He had his nose sliced off in a duel, and he was a very wealthy man, so he just had a silver one. Of course, as you know, Kepler's mentor, more of a provider. They worked together. As you know, Brahe was the observationalist, the experimentalist, and then, of course, Kepler more of the theorist. So Brahe was a bit of an astronomer. But what he loved to do in the evening was throw these lavish parties. One evening, he consumed so much mead, I think it was at the time, that his bladder exploded.
Mm-hmm. Lord, that's a bit much, isn't it? I don't think even Ben Franklin did that.
The mathematical work on the ellipses and the elliptical orbits of the planets still astound astronomers today. You know, Newton probably borrowed some of that. It all really led to the calculus. I think you'd agree. He and Leibniz, it probably facilitated some of their work.
Well, those two independently discovered the logarithmic function.
You know who was really amazing there? Frederick Gauss. You might recall that he, as a young man, had memorized the logarithm tables to an extraordinary level. I'm reading this wonderful book, but two books simultaneously. They were so good, I found them at the same time. They're free online. Listeners who want them, I'll send you copies. It's only 200 or 300 pages. The imaginary tale of the square root of -1, which, as everybody knows, a complex number or an imaginary number.
I have that book.
I can't put it down. Now, I think you'd enjoy Euler, the master of all of us. And I promise you, it's just as good as the imaginary tale of the square root of -1. It actually might be better. Finished these two other books, The Man Who Knew Infinity and the other one called The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, that amazing life of mathematician who was autistic, Paul Erdos. Listeners as well, just send me a request. I'll fire it over to you. Free, available online.
He's a long way back.
Well, no, Erdos, he sadly passed away, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago. There is an interesting documentary about his life. I think it was the Man Who Knew Loved Only Numbers. And he was a fascinating individual, never married, lived with his mother most of his life. And, of course, I think he was mildly autistic, which we now refer to, well, we used to in the American Psychological Association, we used to refer to that Asperger's.
No, autistic.
But now we refer to it as functional autistic. The American Psychological Association just struck Asperger's from their booklet there, and I think the reason why is they felt it was being overused. He was pretty heavily on the autistic spectrum, but he was very functional, and he just flew from town to town, didn't have a resident, and let other mathematicians take care of him. Do you know that my key mentor in university, he has a Paul Erdos number. People get numbers because so many people published work with him over his lifetime. He loved to collaborate with other mathematicians and economists and scientists. They take pride in their what they call their Erdos number. Yeah, one of my best mentors, by the name of Dr. Roger Tutterow at Kennesaw State University, he has a Paul Erdos number of 5. We're way off topic, but you got me on an area that that's where I spend all my spare time. The calculus, these brilliant minds like the Bernoulli family. If you ever want to read about a fascinating family.
I only know the one that was
Jacob Bernoulli, probably. But his brothers were remarkable as well. They worked side by side with Euler. They were contemporaries. Actually, Euler was a young man and made many breakthroughs with them and solved everything they couldn't in their legacy. This book is amazing. Riemann's Hypothesis, but I'll fire over a copy to anybody who wants it. And this is amazing. If you're interested in math and the zeta function and, of course, prime number theory and the prime number theorem, this is your book. Because this man, he only lived to 39, 40 years old, Bernard Riemann. And what he did in that brief period of time, I think in mathematics, it compares to Chopin, who died at 39, and maybe even Ramanujan, who passed away.
I was just thinking of maybe Ramanujan.
He died at like 29 or something like that. It was unbelievably early.
Quite young, but he really astounded Western science.
You want to know who else made a mark? And this will blow your mind. Died at 20. Galois. Galois. I'm probably mispronouncing it. My French-speaking people.
No, that sounds right to me.
He died in a duel the night after he formulated one of the most fascinating proofs in semi-modern mathematics, and his work is still being incorporated today. But I will agree with you on one thing. Ramanujan still blows me away. Just finished his book a few weeks ago, you know, The Man Who Knew Infinity. One thing that really struck me about him, it was all intuitive, Arch. He didn't rely on proofs.
It's incredibly obvious.
Exactly. So maybe we can draw parallels between Ramanujan and Arch Crawford today. It's intuitively obvious. I don't need proofs. And so let's get back on track here. Give us an idea of what's intuitively obvious. Give us an idea of what you see happening in the markets.
I was speaking for him that it's intuitively obvious. Now, I'll say, let me go one more if about the square root of -1, the Zohar says, and no one that I know of has made this connection except me. The Zohar says, desire of desires, that which hangeth in that region which is negatively existent in the ancient one. And I'm saying that is desire of desires means square root. Why would he say desire twice?
I had this wonderful guest, David Gurwitz. He works with Nenner Research and Associates in New York.
I've heard that name.
Oh, yes. You'll hear of Charles Nenner and David Gurwitz. What's interesting is he's also a rabbi. And one of the things he's helped me with over the years is he said, you know, Chris, in our tradition, the word for prediction and knowledge and forecasting goes hand in hand with humility. And what you learn is that they're almost two sides of the same coin. Because I got so enthralled with the square root of minus one, i.e. imaginary numbers, that I threw myself into it for about a week. Oh, I know. A week. Who cares? But, you know, I just absorbed everything that I could. And I came up with a couple little theorems, unproved, no proofs or anything, but a couple of theorems. There was this man by the name of B-U-S, I'm going to mispronounce it, Busi or something. And if you read the square root of minus one book, an imaginary number tale, they talk about it in there, that if you take the square root of minus one, that figure, and you take its reciprocal in the real world, and you combine them, you actually can glean future information. It was really quite a remarkable breakthrough. This is about 150 years ago, and I try to graph it. I try to illustrate his ideas, and I'll forward you. I've got several pictures here on my desktop. I'll forward to you what came out of it. It's got text and illustrations and whatnot. Because, you know, there's a saying in the math world today, Arch, the shortest path to information in our world is through the imaginary plane. So in other words, by learning to embrace the square root of minus one and minus two and three and four and up and down that imaginary line, ascending and descending on the imaginary line, there is a lot of knowledge to be gleaned. We've diverged again from the main topic. We'll give our listeners today so that we can keep the lights on here in the studio. Your feeling about the precious metals market, are the planets aligning in a way, are the technicals aligning in a way to where we could see a sustained rally?
Well, what I said in my most recent letter was that it's the best action that we've seen in the five-year period, and that if it breaks back above 1260, I would add to positions, and if it goes over 12, it did that already. It's at 1266 now. It's done it in the last 2 hours. So if it goes over 1260 to buy more, and if it goes over 1280 to buy with both hands.
You know, that's such an important point because I think you pointed out that we've had a situation where higher highs and higher lows are just something we are, over the last 5 years, we've almost given up on.
Right. They're only just lower lows and lower highs. That's all we had.
You know, that tends to bring in a little bit too much exuberance in that one direction. Are there any astronomical anomalies that support this idea?
Yes. I'm looking for some kind of possible 2008 kinds of things happening this September, October. September tends to be the worst month, and we're now getting the eclipses in September this year. So that's a double whammy, in my opinion.
If you look at a weekly and a monthly, let's just pick the S&P, which I think tends to have one of the more solid trends of the three U.S. indices over time. They're really pronounced trends. That we've had what Edwards and McGee might refer to as a W-style bottom, or what some folks euphemistically refer to as a double bottom. Do you feel, Arch, that we're going to have to wait and see until October? And, of course, that's surprisingly close to the election time as well in November.
Well, don't get me started on that. My opinion is that we will have another false flag event, and perhaps even a larger one than 9/11, and that we won't have an election.
But wouldn't we be seeing telltale signs of that? I mean, wouldn't we be seeing lower lows and lower highs, not stocks breaking out to new highs? Give me just an example. Facebook, red hot this week, all-time new highs, hitting almost 122, I think it was. I'm just trying to give some perspective and some context. What are you seeing that makes you feel that extreme events could be coming?
You're talking about new highs on a couple of top stocks, some good movers. But here's the record going back a ways on the total New York Stock Exchange new highs. And at an important high of May 15th, 2013, there were 536 new highs, and they have trended lower with 472 in October 18th, 2013, 370 on June 6th, 2014. 358 on October 31st, 2014, 350 on January 28th, 2015, 300 on March 20th, 2015, and the latest 218 on March the 30th, 2016.
Not too good, not too sanguine.
That's what you call lower highs.
That's what you call distribution back in the day.
Yes.
So what you're saying is the smart money is embracing these rallies as selling opportunities.
That's what I think. And also the fact that there's so many, much money has been pumped into the system, and that the government or the Fed or both are actively intruding into the market by buying index futures, even on an hour-to-hour basis now. Reagan started this, but they were not intrusive except if they were afraid of a crash at that time. You know, it was done right after the crash of 87. Over the last 5 or 10 years, they've become more and more and more intrusive.
So we're talking about the PPT, the Plunge Protection Team, organized purchases derivatives and leverage possibly through some of the investment banks on behalf of maybe the Treasury, and then again by proxy, our buddies at the Federal Reserve. Follow the money, Arch.
The whole thing is totally phony.
So you're trying to tell me, Arch, that things have gotten so good that people who can't find a job are tossing up their hands.
Well, I've also published charts, I think it was from Investors Business Daily, about the tax revenues from wages, and they show a different story entirely. So either they're lying about the employment numbers.
Fascinating story out of Great Britain this week. They're testing long-haul trucking all throughout Europe, driven by computer, completely by computer. And they're saying that within just not decades from now, but within years, you will see coast-to-coast shipments by these massive trucks that are fully automated through satellite and through self-contained computer systems. There are several car companies who are already putting safe braking systems that brake when you don't, if you accidentally take your eyes off the road and someone, you know, was to jump in front of you. And of course, I don't know if you heard this also, but I believe it was the CEO, Carl's Jr. I don't eat fast food, but I understand there's a restaurant called Carl's Jr. Yeah, I don't have TV, so I'm kind of secluded from the world.
We have turned ours off for the last year and a half.
Good for you. Well, I'm 10, 15 years into it. Carl's Jr.'s CEO, I just want to finish this thought quickly, pointed out we're calling for 100% automation. So you would drive up, talk to a computer voice, swipe your card, and out the chute comes your bag of French fries, completely robotically made, and that's where they're headed. And is that going to be a problem from an economic perspective, or will we suddenly all just become programmers and things of that nature? It seems to me there's a big disconnect here. Any thoughts?
I would say that the opposite is true, that we're importing the programmers and we're dumbing down our own people. It's intentional. Well, they sent Jacobins over here to foment the Civil War. The bankers of Europe sent these people over here.
And you're saying that essentially the globalists have ransacked the Western world, and we're certainly starting to see signs of that.
Since before the Civil War, when they came over here and escaped their clutches.
And so what we refer colloquially here in the southern United States is the War of Northern Aggression. You're saying that now it's really a war of attrition by the entire country.
Somewhat, yeah. But in terms of the War of Northern Aggression, that's because General Lee ran Union troops out of the Confederacy, but he never attacked the Union.
Don't forget, he did attack Gettysburg. He made one assault up there into Gettysburg.
Into Pennsylvania, yeah.
Any contact information for listeners who'd like to sign up for your newsletters?
Crawford Perspectives at earthlink.net is the email. www.crawfordperspectives.com is the website. Google Arch Crawford, you get about 15,000. And the first two or three are the website.
Thank you so much for making time for us, sir.
Superb. Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Louis Navalier runs Navalier & Associates, editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters and several other services as well. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
Good to be here.
Interesting year for the markets. U.S. equities, almost 2,000-point swings. Where are we in the cycle of U.S. equities?
Well, we have a problem. It's the fifth quarter row of negative sales on the S&P, and it's the fourth quarter row of negative earnings, according to FactSet. So there's a sales and earnings problem. There's a leadership problem. Netflix was number one last year, got hit with downgrades this year, struggling. Amazon was number two last year, got hit with downgrades this year, struggling. Apple was a flagship. We've seen it. So what's happening is, on the surface, the market may look okay, but under the surface, it's wild. And your best performing stocks since February 11th, small stocks with huge short interest, horrible analyst revisions, high PE ratios, because they've been propelled by something called a shortcoming rally. We professionals on Wall Street have to be smart enough not to get sucked into all this. And so this is not going to end well. You know, the doesn't float very long. And we're in the middle of an earnings season now. And believe it or not, your best performers since February 11th are the energies, with an average earnings decline of 109%. And 84% of the dividend cuts have come in the energy sector. The second best sector is financials, where the earnings are down 11% on average. You know, money losing does not lead the market, okay? And so what's happening is we're going to have a huge rotation in this market. We're having a flight to quality. I'm having a stunning earnings season. But I got to tell you, it's very, very frustrating for everyone. It's pretty bizarre. And I think we can blame the algorithmic traders, the asset gatherers on Wall Street that gather all these assets. And there's a lot of games being played on Wall Street that a lot of people don't know about, and it seems to be taking a toll a bit.
We oftentimes see near market peaks and zeniths, rotation from the blue chips and the bellwether equities into some of these low float candidates. And as you say, that you see some of the smart money squeezing the shorts. Some of these equities have been naked short sold to the tune of much more than the original float outstanding. So it presents, I think, an opportunity to game the system that you alluded to. I'd also like your comments on the economy. Unemployment up 0.1%, fractional amount, but it does represent, I think, a regime change. I mean, we had seen lower national unemployment rate figures almost consecutively for years, and then suddenly we have an anomaly. Is this a red flag, or again, is it just a statistical fluke?
It's all the above. It's we have some weird statistics from early Easter and stuff, but by and large, the job market is not healthy. Wages went up in January because minimum wage went up. Then they fell in February. Then in March, wage increases decelerated to 1.4% annual pace, well below what the Fed expected. We do have growth in services in America, and that's creating most of the jobs, but they're not good paying jobs. Still way too many of the jobs are temp jobs. There's a problem out there. We have a consumer sentiment issue. We have a GDP problem. We all have to just cheer up and get over this. You know, presidential election years usually do this. But obviously, this is even a more chaotic presidential election year as well. We're waiting on the normal pattern where, you know, the final two candidates run around and suck up to everybody by promising them everything and anything. And that traditionally markets will rally going into the election. But we're all waiting for that to happen.
You know, election years, as you say, there are some question marks. There are some wild cards on the table. As a rule, investors prefer to avoid uncertainty like the plague. On the other hand, you know, we've been in this solid uptrend. This theme has persisted since the 2009 lows following the credit crisis. Do you expect, you know, this consolidation to result with maybe new highs on all three major indices?
Yeah, I do. And I'm going to tell you why, even though I've been very critical of market, why I think it'll be okay. One is this is the worst quarter for earnings. They will get better later in the year. The year-over-year comparisons will get better. Second, on February 11th, when the market made its low, the 30-year Treasury yielded less than the S&P's dividend yield. I've only seen that three times in history. As I speak to you today, the S&P's dividend yield is still way over the 10-year Treasury, even with the dividend cuts. So any company that announces a dividend increase, Constellation Brands, Costco, are being rewarded. So your real key, your best defense right now is a strong offense. So we like companies that have good sales when the S&P doesn't, good earnings, low P ratios, and growing dividends. And so these are things you have to put in your portfolio to protect you so you don't get jerked around by all the wild gyrations out there. And the market still yields more than the bank and treasuries.
Well, you tend to leave us with a few of your favorite candidates. You mentioned, of course, energy shares, big component of the S&P 500. We've seen solid gains after considerable selling and, of course, the underlying West Texas Intermediate crude. That theme at least temporarily changed and really boosted shares last week, which I think helped buoy the market. Do you see better prospects ahead for the energy sector in 2016?
All you're seeing now is a seasonal surge in energy prices. We get it every spring. And come September, we're going to have a downturn. So here's where we are in energy. We have the highest inventories ever recorded in over 80 years. Cushing, Oklahoma is filled. So they're putting oil on tankers, aren't going anywhere. In fact, it's messing up Iran. Iran wants to boost their exports. They can't find tankers because everybody's using them for storage. We have rail cars sitting, not going anywhere, full of oil because, again, Cushing, Oklahoma is filled. We're trying to export our oil, but, you know, with the building a new terminal in Louisiana, it's just slow. Mexico opened up their oil fields, so U.S. Energy Service a while ago. So they got some new supply coming online. Saudi Arabia has lost market share in 9 of its 15 major markets because of growing competition from Angola, Nigeria, Iraq, and Iran. And obviously they don't get along in OPEC. There's deep discounting to lock up long-term contracts. Saudi's trying to get more and more in the refinery business to do that. If you're in the heavy sour crude business, no one wants your oil. So Venezuela is imploded. The client of sales to Venezuela, it's not good. It is an absolute, utter mess out there. And this is a seasonal surge. Last year, we saw energy pop 19% in 3 days and 24% in 4 days. There can be a lot of short covering around the end of the month. There can be these gyrations. People are spreading rumors, you know, that say there's a deal, they're going to cut. They're not. There's no deal. There's a glut. And the only reason that energy went up is it was the springtime. It will be crashing in the fall. So, you know, if it starts to go up in September, I take it all back, okay? But there's nothing that's going to get energy up other than like a war or something. And it's not happening. And we have very lackluster global growth as well. So, no, energy, this is not a good place to put your money. The dividend cuts are incredible. Even Exxon got a credit downgrade. So very, very serious problems in the energy patch to this day.
So despite remarkable haircut in crude oil over the past couple of years, especially, but really over 5 consecutive years, you feel that the equities themselves don't really represent a solid value here. Not yet. We haven't quite reached that floor. You also keep your eye, though, on the technology sector, and I'd like to know if there's any individual components or individual stocks that you're, you know, maybe eyeing now as potential candidates for your portfolio.
Sure. I like AVGO, Broadcom, because when Apple had disclaimer, it got spooked, so it's a core holding of ours. I do like Facebook, which is Beat. It's a monopoly. It's monetized the business very well. I'm not that upset with Google. I'm not recommending it yet, but it's not a bad stock. It missed the other day, but still has very strong sales growth. I despise Netflix. I wouldn't touch it. It's way too pricey. Compression. I'm a Netflix user because I got kids. I'm also an Amazon user, and I would never buy the stock. It hit almost 1,000 times earnings last year, despite three negative quarters in a row. It had a positive fourth quarter, but 38% below estimates. The nicest thing I can say about Amazon, it trades at only 200 times forecasted earnings. So what's essentially happening out there is you got to find tech that either dominates its business like Facebook and gets a fat operating margin, I throw a Google in that camp too, or, you know, it's got strong sales and earnings like an AVGO or Broadcom. And it's really tough out there. Data security, Palo Alto Networks, PA&W would be another one I like. So we're finding some, but it's slim pickings.
On board with you with Facebook, just broke out to a new all-time record high this week, briefly touching, I think it was over 120, 122, something in that neighborhood. So it's certainly the trend, the theme has been higher over the last 2 years, persisting regardless of these gyrations. I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about one of the hottest sectors of 2016, and that's what keeps the lights on here at GoldSeek, the yellow metal. What do you think about the sector?
Well, you know, we just wrote a special report on gold, and you're welcome to use our report, but it was basically how gold is increasingly attractive because it doesn't have a negative interest rate. We have negative interest rates from central banks around the world. There's a lack of confidence in central banks. Everybody's upset about all the money pumping, and gold zigged in the first quarter when everything zagged. Obviously, if you were in Europe and bought gold, you made more money on it because of its price in dollars, and the dollar was strong the last few years, but now it makes more sense if you're in America. I prefer the physical gold. I know some of the gold miners and stuff are rallying. Even I have one I'm recommending. It goes through the tallings and basically recovers some of the gold. But I can tell you that it's a core allocation to most people, and it's been increased because there's just a lack of confidence in central banks around the world. So gold deserves a higher allocation in most people's portfolio.
There's obviously a lot of opportunity in global equities.
The euro rallied here recently, and the reason it rallied is Britain's going to vote to leave the EU on June 23rd. No one's sure what's going to happen, but that's why the euro rallied. The British pound was an oasis, just like the dollar was an oasis. So I guess that's the big wild card out there. I think when all the dust settles, I think the dollar will remain being very strong because we have higher rates than the rest of the world. We do have a stronger economy than the rest of the world, even though it's lackluster. Americans are more optimistic than other people around the world, so I just think we should all cheer up and move on. I would love it when our final two presidential candidates start sucking up to everybody. I'm waiting for that to commence, and hopefully it'll work. The election outcome looks still uncertain to a lot of people, but most people think Hillary has the edge. I'm not sure what Trump has to do to win the female votes.
All right, as we wrap up today, Louis Navalier, please tell our listeners more about Navalier & Associates and any other services that you'd like to discuss.
Sure. Well, Navalier is increasingly over the years become more of a family office. I'm my own biggest investor. I see my own products. I have a whole bunch of new mutual funds I started. I left a big fund company a year ago. When you see the fund and you grow it, the money pouring in dilutes the tax distribution. So I have very tax-efficient funds. Dividend growth has invaded all our portfolios. So we are very good at dividend management. We have a dividend grader online. Basically, though, we want it all nowadays. We want dividend growth. We want good sales, good earnings. We don't pay too high of a P ratio. We just try to take money and compound it. We did great in CNBC stock picking contests last year up 18-1 and doing great this year. I've had a phenomenal earnings surprise season already. But we're going to give people a smoother ride out there. So they can invest in our funds or manage accounts. They can go online, get our free stock graders. And dividend graders. There's a lot of tools out there we offer, but we exist to help people.
Louis Navalier, we appreciate your thoughts and look forward to more financial market commentary in 2016.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A lot of topics of critical importance are just now beginning to be discussed in mainstream media, now that the Republican presidential field has narrowed to a candidate of one, with Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee for the party. In a lengthy interview with Wolf Blitzer of CNN, the debt situation of Puerto Rico was discussed. It's worth watching if you haven't seen it yet, because Mr. Trump says Puerto Rico should not be bailed out, but did indicate their debt, which is massive for their size, will prevent them from surviving economically. There's no doubt Mr. Trump is an expert at restructuring debt. What that restructuring might look like was not defined, but he did say they will be unable to pay the interest on their bonds, so the debt can't just be restructured, it must be cut way down. He went on to say the U.S. debt problem is escalating and will soon grow from $19 trillion to $21 trillion, and that the U.S. is soon going to be in the same position as Puerto Rico, because, as he emphasized, we have too much debt. Actually, the U.S. debt is much larger than the acknowledged $19 or soon to be $21 trillion. When you factor in unfunded liabilities, off-budget items, and the whirlwind of other hidden obligations. But if Donald Trump believes we are on the edge of another debt crisis with $19 or $21 trillion, which we are, then the time for action is soon upon us. In my GoldSeek commentary from July 4th of 2015, right about the time the Puerto Rico debt problem was coming to light, and right about the time I heard Donald Trump speak live for the first time, I did a GoldSeek commentary about what might happen when the economic dominoes eventually fall in Puerto Rico. Donald Trump has now stated he does not favor a bailout for Puerto Rico. In July of last year, I discussed how Puerto Rico's debt problem keeps growing, and like countries, businesses, and individuals the world over, Puerto Rico is trying to solve a debt problem with more debt. In the long run, it isn't going to work. I said the stage has been set to turn Puerto Rico into a laboratory of debate and experimentation that could potentially show the United States and the Western Hemisphere what could happen here under certain circumstances if certain economic measures are not enacted. I discussed an IMF report for proposed reforms in Puerto Rico that I believe will never see the light of day in the United States, not until at least it was a last resort. The special interests at all points on the political spectrum are too powerful to let these things happen without a real fight. Things like cutting teachers, raising property taxes, trimming the minimum wage, restructuring utilities, and exempting the island from federal laws that make the island less competitive. Puerto Rico is not a state yet. They are not eligible for bankruptcy protection on their own accord. We could well see a volatile chain of economic events in Europe and the world over that could finally be enough to establish statehood for Puerto Rico, possibly even before the November 2016 elections. And now that Donald Trump has indicated he does not favor a bailout, perhaps the stage has been set for the current administration to enact one preemptively. But even if it doesn't, one has to ask, will the Puerto Rican government shut down if it defaults? Will Congress here in the U.S. pass some kind of emergency measures or bailout plan that will leave the taxpayers holding the bag? Or does Washington allow Puerto Rico to fail so the IMF can impose its own version of a bailout plan as a test pilot program for the entire world to see? Since there has been so much resistance to IMF austerity measures throughout Europe. If there is no bailout from the U.S., it seems to suggest this is still a realistic possibility. And if the financial dominoes start falling in Puerto Rico, that crisis will make its way to the U.S. because Puerto Rico's bonds are traded in the U.S. municipal bond markets and will affect other debt-ridden states. So, just as we discussed nearly a year ago, this situation is coming home to roost and is now making its way into the presidential campaign dialogue. The banks have already protected themselves with bail-in measures. Should the government not embark upon any more bailout programs because of their political unpopularity? The question for anyone listening who happens to attend a Trump, Clinton, or Sanders rally is to pin the candidates down on what a restructuring or write-down of massive debt, for example, on Puerto Rico, would look like to the American people and to businesses. If the government is not going to bail out foreign countries, how will financial institutions cover themselves from losses that do occur? Ask the candidates about not only where they stand on bailout, but ask them where they stand on bail-ins. In other words, are they going to work to prevent banks from looting the deposits of individuals and businesses in a financial crisis to cover their losses? And if lenders are forced to write down debt, from where will it be subsidized? Or if it will be subsidized? We must know where our political leaders stand on both bailouts and bail-ins. If this question can make its way into the political mainstream before the election, the discussion and substance of future economic policy may actually make a difference come November, and from an accountability perspective, afterwards. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. I'm not the one.